Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Since his COVID diagnosis, the president's health has filled headlines every day this week and even became a question from moderator Susan Page during Wednesday's vice presidential debate.
One of you will make history on January 20th. You will be the vice president to the oldest president the United States has ever had. Donald Trump will be 74 years old on Inauguration Day. Joe Biden will be 78 years old. That already has raised concerns among some voters, concerns that have been sharpened by President Trump's hospitalization in recent days. Vice President Pence, have you had a conversation or reached an agreement with President Trump about safeguards or procedures when it comes to the issue of presidential disability? And if not, do you think you should?
Amid all these questions about President Trump's health, yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced legislation under the auspices of the Constitution's 25th Amendment that would allow Congress to create a commission to determine if the president is physically and mentally fit for office. Just last night, he referred repeatedly on Fox News to the mayor of Russia. Well, reporters have pressed President Trump's physicians for details. His doctors have yet to give a full and consistent accounting of when the president last tested negative. But the reluctance to tell the full story about the commander-in-chief's health is nothing really new. In fact, it goes back to the early days of the Republic. David Priest joins me now to look at this lesser-known history. He wrote about it in the Washington Post last week. He's the chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute, a visiting fellow at the National Security Institute of George Mason University, and a former CIA intelligence officer. He's the author of the book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, and Unfit Chief Executives. Welcome back to All of It, David.
Hi, Allison. Good to talk to you.
So over the last 10 days, President Trump's doctors have refused to say when his last known negative COVID test was. It's been reported that his administration asked doctors at Walter Reed to sign NDAs when he was there last year. How typical is it for doctors to be caught up in the politics when the president is the patient?
Yeah, you know, for a president who is so inclined to shatter norms and do things differently than his predecessors, this has to be the one time that he actually follows precedent. We have a long history of presidents and those around them who, at a minimum, withhold certain information about a medical crisis of the president from the public. And in many cases, they do much more than that. They actively deceive the public and give them misinformation, knowing that they're lying in order to cover up the severity of a presidential illness. So I wasn't too surprised to see this, both because this administration tends to hold its cards close to its vest on just about everything and not be overly forthcoming, but especially from this long history of presidents who don't tell the public about their severe health conditions.
Let's talk about the 25th Amendment, because people are talking about it a lot in the past couple of days. Section 1 of the 25th Amendment states, in case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. Mm-hmm. It wasn't ratified until after JFK's death in 1963. What was the protocol before this amendment?
Yeah, the 25th Amendment actually does quite a lot in a few short sections. So the first section, as you mentioned, absolute clarity of something that had been established by precedent by earlier presidential deaths and vice presidential successions, but it wasn't entirely clear in the Constitution. The Constitution did not make clear that the vice president became the president. It said that the vice president shall assume the duties and powers of the office, something like that, but it didn't actually make them president. Well, vice presidents who succeeded dead presidents acted like president, and people generally understood that that's what they were, but the 25th Amendment made that absolutely clear. That would have been very important if Kennedy would have not died, but instead would have gone into a coma, but it wouldn't have clarified exactly what to do in that case. We knew that the vice president should become president if the president died, but how would you determine if the president was not dead, but couldn't act as president? And that's why they came up with other sections of the amendment. The relevant ones here, Section 3, the president can declare himself disabled and unable to perform the duties of the presidency and temporarily grant power to the vice president. And this has happened three times. Ronald Reagan did it once when he was in surgery. George W. Bush did it twice when he was in surgery. And nothing happened. For a matter of hours, we had vice presidents acting as president. The one that's getting a lot of attention now, Allison, is Section 4. And this is the one whereby the vice president, along with the majority of the cabinet, or, and this is important, any other body that Congress shall designate, have to determine that the president is disabled, and therefore they can take power away from the president against his will for a temporary period of time while he is disabled. The amendment says that it's supposed to be the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, but it also does give Congress the ability to legislate, to say, no, we want to substitute another body for the cabinet, but it doesn't get rid of the vice president. The vice president has to agree that the president is disabled, or it doesn't matter what that other body Congress has designated says. The president is not going to have his powers and duties taken away from him unless the vice president says it needs to be done.
Now, David, you worked in intelligence for decades. Is the president's health always a matter of national security?
Absolutely. And in every way, it is a matter personally, because this is the person who, in the ultimate national security nightmare, authorizes nuclear strikes. And if you don't have that person available to do that, that is a national security vulnerability. But it matters for things less than that nightmare scenario, too. So national security decision making on a daily basis about troop deployments, about how to work with allies in certain war zones, about what to do to set up means to make sure that we are not attacked in the future. If the president is unable to engage in those meetings, to understand the intelligence being briefed to him, and to act on it, that's a national security problem. It's also a problem because it emboldens adversaries. That is, other countries around the world can look at the United States, and if they're scratching their head about whether the president is fully in control, that's a time when there's a lot of pushing at the margins and people taking advantage of it. There's some speculation out there now that Armenia and Azerbaijan, which are in a shooting war, that perhaps they're taking advantage of this period where the American president is distracted.
My guest is David Preece. His article was "Presidents Have Often Deceived the Public About Their Illness." It appeared in the Washington Post. All right, let's get into history. This is some of this stuff is fascinating. Mm-hmm. The secret illness goes all the way back to James Madison, our fourth president. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the first line of a letter written from James Monroe to Thomas Jefferson, dated Washington, June 28, 1813. "Dear sir, from the date of my last letter to you, the president has been ill of a bilious fever of that kind called the remittent." What happened to Madison in 1813?
Yeah, Madison got ridiculously sick. He was bad with this intestinal ailment and a very high fever. It knocked him down and kept him there for weeks on end. At one point, it was so severe that he couldn't even read congressional resolutions that had been brought to him in the White House. Now he did recover eventually, but there was not a lot of candor coming out of the White House about his condition. People knew he was sick, but people didn't know exactly how sick. All they knew was that he was not going to be present at Congress in order to see them, and it was unclear when he would recover. And it really set a bad precedent, Allison, because the lack of communication, and honestly, the American public doesn't need to know about any president's exact timing, as opposed to, you know, 12:15 p.m. versus 12:16 p.m. of when they received a medication. That level of precision may not be important. But knowing the general scope of the president's health and the severity of the condition and what the treatments are, that's generally something that would be good for people to know to assess the condition of the presidency. And James Madison started that out on a bad road.
Let's talk about Grover Cleveland in 1893. There was a growth in his mouth, of President Cleveland's mouth. He'd just been elected again, and it was found to be malignant. They went to great lengths to keep this quiet.
This is a crazy story, and one that even as a kid who was interested in presidential history, I don't remember ever hearing this I remember Grover Cleveland coming up because he was the president. So nice. We elected him twice. He's the only president who was elected twice, but non-successive terms. That is, he had 4 years off and then decided he wanted to go back. That's all I really knew about him. But it turns out that this man who was generally regarded as an honest, forthright person, part of what won him the presidency, pulled off one of the greatest deceptions in the American presidency. So he had this cancer that he had to have removed. But this was an era in the 1890s when cancer was the disease that shall not be named. It was the Voldemort of its time. People could not say the word because it was considered so heinous. So rather than admit that he had it and try to get rid of it in a safe fashion, they devised a scheme whereby the president would take his regular vacation by taking a boat from Washington up to Cape Cod and would just take a little bit longer than usual to get there. What they didn't tell people was that was because they had a small team of surgeons on this yacht, and they were tying the president to a chair, which in turn would be tied to one of the masts of the yacht, and they would perform the surgery on the open water. Horribly risky thing to do. Thankfully, the seas were relatively calm, which made it easy. But if anything had gone wrong, they did not have a large, experienced team of medical experts to help the few doctors that were performing the surgery. It turned out well in almost every regard. That is, they got the tumor. They removed much of his jaw, some of his teeth, and then he spent weeks recovering and eventually had a prosthetic put in, and most people couldn't tell the difference. But it didn't turn out well for one young, intrepid reporter who did catch wind of this, reported the story, and was vilified by the White House and the president's political allies and basically ruined his career. And it was only after Cleveland died that the story came out that this reporter had been right and the honest Grover Cleveland had pulled one over on the American people.
My guest is David Priest. His article is called Presidents Have Often Deceived the Public About Their Illness. Let's get to Woodrow Wilson. I made a presidential scholar laugh by saying, we've already had a female president, Edith Wilson.
That's right. The president's wife was the de facto president for at least months. This was a really sad case. Woodrow Wilson had a massive stroke late in his presidency and was unable to function in virtually every way for several weeks. And as months went by, he was recovering but still not able to perform the duties of the office. Rather than let the vice president take over, instead, his wife, Edith, and his doctor, Dr. Carrie Grayson, conspired to keep the truth from being known. People knew the president was sick. They announced he was a sick man, but they attributed it to exhaustion and other ailments, but they were not willing to admit that he had had a virtually paralyzing stroke that left him unable to function. So what happened is eventually, as executive correspondence stacked up and up and up, most business of government stopped. Most things that required any presidential input simply stopped. For the most essential things, Edith stepped in. And what she did, thinking of herself as the person who knew Woodrow Wilson's thinking the best, she would decide what he would have done had he been able to fully weigh in. And then she would sign documents with his hand, that is, take his hand and actually sign the documents. So she could say, yes, he signed the documents. But it certainly appears as if she was giving a great deal of assistance and took a great deal of leeway with her ability to get these documents moved out of the White House. Now, we were lucky in that we had finished World War I. There were certainly major national issues to be discussed, but there was no impending crisis that got in the way. But that couldn't be said in the post-World War II world. And during the Cold War, the whole idea was we can't have another situation like this. And you were right. John F. Kennedy's experience brought this to a head, and knowledge of what happened with Wilson, which came out over the years, and knowledge of what could have happened with John F. Kennedy did lead to that 25th Amendment, whereby, yes, if you really need to, you can get power to the vice president.
I want to go back to Wilson because this is interesting. They weren't just controlling the information about the president going out, but also the information coming in. Mm-hmm. How much was being kept from the president?
We will probably never know the full answer to that. It appears that he was unable to process much of anything for some period of time. And then as time went on and they started building material back up for him, he did catch on, such that by the end of his term, people were talking about him running again for a third term. Now, that did not happen, but he was clearly able to hold conversations and to process documents by the end of his term in early 1921. Now, the problem we have is the paper flow was controlled by the doctor and by Edith Wilson. And what he saw and what he responded to, we don't know. We have reports of people who met with him. And certainly as time went on, he was able to hold conversations and engage with them. But it's a weird case where we truly don't know how aware the president was of what was being done in his name, and what was his legacy as a president is certainly tarred by the fact that the last few months of his presidency, we can't necessarily ascribe anything good that happened to him, and we can't necessarily blame anything that happened that was bad to him.
Let's move on to FDR, who never appeared in his wheelchair publicly or acknowledged that he wore leg braces. But the lasting effects of polio, that wasn't the only health issue for FDR. When did his health start to decline?
Yeah, this is funny. I spoke with some members of his family and experts on FDR to try to find that out. And most people nail it down into the 1943-1944 range. He had long had other health ailments other than the one that he is most famous for, which is the fact that the press generally kept pictures of him in a wheelchair out of public view. They helped the president not highlight the fact that he was unable to move without leg braces. But the bigger issue was the fact that he had much deeper health issues that really got worse in late 1943 and 1944. And yet, unlike Wilson, who stepped aside, FDR was running again. And he was a candidate for the presidency for his fourth term in 1944. And he started to decline rapidly during that year. He still had moments of great lucidity and even good physical moments, but he had other moments where people saw him and he was drooling into the saucer. He couldn't hold his cup of tea or coffee without shaking. Sometimes he couldn't focus and he would just stare into the distance. And it turned out his health was even worse than many people within his family knew, because he didn't want his doctors to tell him all the details, because then he had plausible deniability when he could say, well, my doctors have told me I'm doing fine. But the doctors also did not overshare that information, even with people close to the president. So it wasn't a surprise to people who had seen him up close, like his personal secretary, when he did die early in 1945, because they had seen this rapid decline over the previous year or two.
My guest is David Priest, former CIA intelligence officer and historian. He recently wrote a piece for The Washington Post called Presidents Have Often Deceived the Public About Their Illness. Let's talk about Eisenhower, because he had several health scares while in office, and he kind of drew up a succession plan in case he was incapacitated. How did that language end up influencing, if it did, the 25th Amendment?
Yeah, it sure did, Allison. Ike did us a favor, which is he had some health scares, and although he didn't handle them perfectly, he was more forthcoming about his health care and the conditions. And he realized that this isn't going well. We're in the Cold War, and at times it was flaring up during his administration. If something happens to me and I can't acknowledge it and I can't figure it out, I need to make sure that the vice president takes over. So he wrote a letter and came up with an arrangement with the vice president, who at that point was Richard Nixon, that the vice president would take over if he felt the need and if the president could not function as president. Now, whether this would have been, you know, a legal document or not, he did have the attorney general look at it, but it was not codified into law. It was not in the Constitution. It was simply an informal agreement between the president and the vice president. Now, that works really well if everyone is in agreement, but of course it leaves open, does everyone else buy into it? So after Eisenhower's experience and after the experience of John Kennedy's assassination, when people realized how bad it would have been if that bullet had been slightly over and only put Kennedy into a coma instead of killed him, they decided to write the 25th Amendment, which was ratified in 1967, to actually create the process by which a vice president can take the power from the president if needed. And they did borrow from Eisenhower's letter because they found that it covered the issues very well.
In terms of Kennedy, I think as a country, we didn't know how poor his health was. It wasn't revealed for decades, but now we know he had painkillers in office to treat his back. He had, I believe it was Addison's disease, ulcers, right. Colitis. What impact did this have on his presidency?
Yeah, there's a real parallel now because we knew about some of these conditions, the back pain, the Addison's disease, which caused hormone deficiencies, and other conditions. These all spurred him to take a pretty heavy cocktail of steroids and other drugs while in office. And there could be whole dissertations written about Kennedy and his doctors. But the fact is, number one, the American people didn't know about the condition Kennedy was in much of the time. And it's not even clear if Kennedy knew. That is, the effects of these steroids and other drugs interacting could have had effects on his personality and decision making that he himself was unaware of. The concern there is if it simply amplifies some of the personality of the patient, most people around them won't notice. They will just notice, oh, he's particularly riled up today, or he's particularly sedated today, but they won't take it as something that could be disabling. The parallel now for the White House is if the president is on a similarly heavy cocktail of steroids and other drugs, what effect is that happening? If the side effect of a drug is megalomania or a sense of paranoia or a sense of grandiose delusions, how do you tell the difference if that is the base condition of the patient anyway? And does it affect decision making? It's a very hard calculation to do. And it's a much harder calculation when we don't know the exact medications that a president is taking.
My last question for you is, as we've gone through this list, several of the presidents who hid their poor health were also facing some sort of crisis. Grover Cleveland, the recession caused by the Panic 1893, FDR, and World War II. Why is it important for there to be transparency surrounding a president's health when the nation is in crisis?
It really puts into question the handling of the crisis and whether the decisions being made are being made under ideal conditions. It's hard enough to be president. I know we don't sympathize with presidents much because, after all, they sought the job. But it's hard to be president. Only the toughest decisions tend to get to your desk because the easy ones are worked out at a much lower level of bureaucracy. So when a tough decision comes, in normal times, you want a president who is on her game or on his game. But especially during a crisis, you don't want to have questions about whether there's any incapacity, whether there's any fuzzy thinking or an inability to comprehend consequences and to think logically. That's a real problem in our system. Thankfully, we have mechanisms for removing a president, but you have to have the courage to implement them. And one of the biggest concerns, you started this segment with the question at the vice presidential debate about, Mr. Pence, have you had conversations with the president about things like this? He did not even try to answer the question. He went completely away from it. The vice presidential debate should have been all about those kinds of questions, about when you should invoke the 25th Amendment or not. How will you prepare to take on the job of the presidency during a crisis if the president is incapacitated? Those are all fair questions during an election year.
David Priest, a historian, a former CIA intelligence officer, and the author of this great article. You definitely want to read it, called Presidents Have Often Deceived the Public About Their Illness. David, thanks for being with us again and for sharing all of your work.
Thanks for having me. I have a feeling I'll be back as we continue to face some of these issues with presidents.
You are always welcome.